All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Jim Fear 138 podcast. A special episode because the guy whose book I've been raving about for the past, like, 2 or 3 weeks has deigned to come on the podcast. This is Russell Newquist, author of War Demons.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
I'm great, man. It is good to finally get you on the show. This should have honestly happened weeks ago, but my slow ass took forever to read the book, and I apologize about that, but...
It's more than okay. I'm pretty busy these days, so I'm glad we're able to make it happen. I'm glad I'm on.
This book, how did this book, like, kind of conceptualize? Did you like have the characters first? Because it's such an interesting concept to me. The urban fantasy genre is one of my favorite genres. Ever since I read Stormfront by Jim Butcher, which this is right up there with, in my opinion. But how did this idea kind of come together? Because it seems like such an original thing to, you know, not give the main character any kind of magic, like specifically avoid giving the main character any kind of magical powers in a world where there's like wizards and dragons and demons and things like that. So,
well, first off, let me just say thank you. Being compared to Jim Butcher is about the best I could ask for, so I really appreciate that. As far as the actual question, this particular book, it was a long time in the making. This is my first novel, and it took a very long time to get out. It's been almost 4 years since I started the book, and hopefully none of the others will take anywhere near that long, because that's way too long to actually make a living in this industry. So it kind of started from several different places that all came together to make the final finished product. I started writing the book, and really oddly, because I do tend to write just kind of what scenes come to me, very oddly, the prologue was actually the very first part that I wrote.
Oh, the part that takes place in Afghanistan with the knight and the monk and... those guys.
Yeah, and that was just kind of, you know, I wrote it and I was like, okay, you know, I kind of have this thing. And then, you know, and then I didn't really know where to go with it after that. And I started writing some more, and I kind of picked up, with what became chapter two. It started out, it was chapter one and I was writing it, and, you know, I got into it and I'm like, okay, I kind of get where this is going. And that was a little bit from... I kind of had this idea for a bit of an urban fantasy thing where the guy comes, you know, has these bad experiences out in the desert in Afghanistan and whatever, and everything kind of follows him home. And then I kind of put a little bit of my own experience in there. Some of my own feelings towards school probably came through in that character.
I can imagine, like, reading those scenes, having been in college, it's very organic, I suppose, is the word.
I'm not born to be astute. Some people are. Some people just thrive in that environment, and I chafed under it completely. So that character is actually not me anymore, but that part of him very much is. So, you know, that was kind of in there, and I was kind of writing it, and I got the first, you know... 10 or 15,000 words written. And I kind of sent it over to my wife, and she took a look at it, and she's like, yeah, you know, this is kind of okay. It's not too bad. And then I didn't know where I was going with the book at all at that point. And then I kind of had a few other things hit me. The first one, and this was when the book really started to come together, was, I kind of had an amalgamation of two different things, and if you've read the book, you'll and you have enough of a background, you'll totally understand where these two things come from. One is, at the time, like I said, this was 4 years ago. At the time, I was kind of watching season one of Arrow. You know, so if you remember that storyline from season one, there's a teeny bit of that was like, I'm going to add a little bit of this to the character. You know, guy comes home, he's had some really screwy relationships in the past, and, you know, a little bit of that. But the part that really made the book come together is the part that is absolutely not me about Michael, but it is actually based on reality. I played World of Warcraft with a guy who actually joined the army the day after September 11th because his fiance died.
Oh, really? Yeah, I was going to ask about that because that's like a very kind of touchy subject, 9/11. And
Right.
I don't really see a lot of authors out there willing to not only just like insert it into a story without it being some kind of preachy political message, but just to kind of touch it in general and then make that the main character's motivation for going to war. That's something I've never encountered before.
It was a bit of a risk, but then I also looked at it, and there were a lot of stories of that nature that came out of the Vietnam era, that were very much about somebody goes off and they're really changed fundamentally by it and going through a lot. And I'm like, that's really what it is for our generation. And I added it in, and I made a few other changes, and I added in the chapter that became chapter one now. At the graveyard scene with the two of them, and made a few other changes to the story, what I'd written so far, and I sent it back to my wife, and she looked at it and she says, "Well, I hope you're not offended by this, but it actually feels like a real book now." So, I had that, and so I was about 15,000 words into it, and I was going, and I was. Then I was hitting a point where I'm like, okay, I don't really know where I'm going with this story, but I've written 15,000 words. I need to finish this before I pick up something else. But at the same time, I had this other character that had been floating in my head. And you mentioned Jim Butcher before. I'm a huge fan of the Dresden Files, but I also believe that Jim Butcher is telling it wrong. I'm convinced that it's actually the adventures of Michael Carpenter. As told by Harry Dresden. So he's the character that always interested me. So I had this thing, I'm like, well, Jim Butcher's never going to let me write that character, so I'm going to have to make it my own. And I've written a few short stories about this other character, Peter Bishop, who's in there. And I really wanted to write more about him, but I was like, well, I better finish this book first. And I got a certain point into it, and this was never the intention when I started it, but I got a certain point into it, and I realized. Quite unintentionally, this is Peter Bishop's origin story. And then I kind of ran with that. And everything, the last piece that really brought it all together was that I was at Dragon Con a few years ago, and there was a panel run by a guy named Kyle Cobb, who is a actual paranormal investigator. But he's not the crazy kind. It was like a more of an academic kind of paranormal investigator. And he had this panel where he was talking about Eastern demons, and he started talking about this yellow-nosed Saranaa demon that possessed people.
So
And
that's actually like a real
that's
legend.
actually a legit thing. And I didn't make that up. And that's where it came. I was sitting in there in that panel, and I was like, I found it. I found the monster for my book. And I went home, and everything kind of came together from that point. And put the story together, and then I had to go through a few drafts with it because it was my first novel, and the first draft was decent, but really, really needed the polish. So, and that's kind of the long, convoluted story of how this book came together. The sequels are much simpler in how they've evolved, of course, but the first one kind of took a bit to find it.
That makes sense. I mean, it's not exactly like a convoluted story, but there's a lot of twists and turns to it, and a lot of things kind of it kind of feels like some stuff just not appears out of the blue, but was kind of added in later.
Right.
And it like I say, it's not a bad thing. It's a great book, but
Yeah.
it does feel like a lot of work was put into it, and there were some revisions going on just. Just reading it and getting a feel for the creative process.
Yeah, this one was. And I'm really glad to hear how well it's gone over. It is my first novel, and I finished it, and I was very happy with it, and I also looked at it and said, I can do better than that next time. So, hopefully it's coming over well.
Well, that's not a bad attitude to take. I mean, your first attempt at something is never going to be as good as you want it to be, but you can take it as a learning experience and then, do better next time.
Right.
So one thing that really interests me about this book is the religious aspect to it. Because that's, once again, not something that I see a lot of people tackling in either fantasy or science fiction is giving like a respectful nod or putting religion in their books as a thing that actually has power, as opposed to something that's just believed by crazy people.
Right. Well, that kind of came from a couple different places as well. Obviously, I am Catholic myself, but I'm an adult convert to Catholicism and a fairly recent one. We joined the church about 6 years ago, so it hasn't been a super long time. And this is going to sound really crazy because Jim Butcher is not Catholic, but the character of Michael Carpenter was one of many influences that brought me there. And it's one of the reasons I have an attachment to that character. There's a lot of reasons, but I'm assuming you've read the more or less the entire Dresden Files series.
I have not. I've read Stormfront. That's
That's
about it. I have the second and third book in the series, but I haven't actually cracked them yet. But Stormfront was very enjoyable.
They get better. A lot better. I enjoyed that book a lot, but the later marks in the series are really good. Well, if that's the case, then I won't go into everything because I don't want to spoil that
well,
series.
I'm going
you.
To go and read it anyway, but if you don't want to spoil it for the listeners, then that's perfectly acceptable.
There's some really amazing stuff in there, but Michael Carpenter is a modern day knight in Dresden's world, and he's very religious as well, specifically Catholic in the story. And, you know, one of the things about him that kind of really struck home with me was how, and this is very true to a lot of religious people in real life, the honest religious people, not the fake religious people, how very happy he was. You know, he took his life really well and, you know, lived a good one. And, I'll talk around it a little bit so I don't spoil it too much. There's a point in the books where one particular orphan ends up going to live in the Carpenter household. And, you know, it's a very emotional point in the book because you're sitting there reading it and you're thinking, well, if I was an orphan, I'd want to be raised by Michael Carpenter. you know, and it anyway, it kind of struck home. But the character as a whole was really interesting to me. But one of the things that also struck me is that in Butcher's world, as most modern urban fantasy does, when they're not taking Christianity as craziness, they're taking it as, oh, one of many beliefs that kind of sort of reflects what's really going on. Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I was like, well, okay, that's fine. But that was interesting 30 years ago when nobody really did that. And then people started doing it. But now it's the default and it's the norm and it's kind of boring again, in my opinion. So I was like, well, what if we just take it as no, we just take it for granted that the Christian, I'll call it mythology, if you will, the just not so much the theology, but all of the,
like the cosmological worldview.
Yeah, the cosmological worldview. What if that's correct? What if that's actually what it really is? And, you know, a lot of stuff used to, like Western literature as a whole used to take that for granted. The example I like to give is Dracula.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was something that I noticed while reading this book was one of the comparisons that I would make it make with it is to Dracula. Because in Dracula, Van Helsing is, you know, an older man and he's got experience with the church and he knows all of this stuff. And like the communion wafer and holy water and things like that, the crucifix, they deter Dracula. They deter the vampire. They contain his power. They give the people a way to defend themselves in the book. And it takes that aspect of things very seriously. Like Catholicism is taken as read in Dracula as being true.
But at the same time, it's not a book that's trying to convert anybody. And partly because in their day and age, he just assumed everybody was Christian. So, you know, that's what Stoker assumed about his audience. Well, I kind of took that, a little bit of that and a little bit of like a modern day fantasy book, just writing about another fantasy religion. Like you're writing your book, you assume within your world, your religion is true. So if you're not Christian and you're listening to this, I'm not trying to beat anybody over the head with it. Just view it as another fantasy religion that, in this case, inside the world of the story, is assumed to be true. And that's the way I took it. And from an author's perspective, one of the really wonderful things about that is that there's 2,000 years of history on this that you can draw from, and it kind of cuts down on the world building, and lets you do world building in other ways. But
And
so
that
yeah,
was another
that's.
thing that really impressed me about this book was that the Catholicism is taken as read as being true in the story, and God is a power that literally exists in this world, and you have to have faith in God. It's very grounded in that sense of religiosity, even when Michael is kind of struggling with himself, and like he believes, but he's kind of operating under his own power and hoping that God will kind of just like nudge him along in the right direction. But
Right, and that.
it doesn't preach, and that's one thing that I really liked about the book, because a lot of Christian fiction really gets into the preachiness and they're trying to spread a message, they're not trying to tell a story, whereas with this book it was the exact opposite. The message is there to further the story, and in doing so, it furthers the message, more so than if you had just written the book to preach about Catholicism.
I really appreciate hearing that, because that was what I was going for as the goal, and I'm glad to hear that it comes off that way to an atheist. My Christian friends liked it, and so far so have my atheist friends, and that's really what I was hoping for. It also ties into something you were noting right back at the beginning about the main character not having any magical powers, and that ties in again to the Christian worldview of it. Which is that in the actual old honest traditional Christian worldview is not the modern worldview that magic doesn't exist. It's the worldview that magic exists and it's all evil. And so, having a hero in the story who wields actual magic completely breaks with the worldview of the story. So, I had to tie that in. And even the one main, protagonist who is, one might argue, magical, the difference is in the Christian worldview is he's not wielding his own magical power. He's, wielding the power of God to further God's will.
Right, he's more like a cleric in Dungeons and Dragons than,
Or a paladin
Harry
is
Dresden. Yeah,
actually the
Paladin. Yeah, that's a better example.
yeah, and that's not even the word I used until a friend of mine used it, and I was like, yes, that's actually exactly right. So it kind of grew out of that. It was a case of and also from the original story concept, which in the original story concept is just, yeah, it's just this soldier who, was out in the desert and saw some scary crap and had to deal with it. So yeah, it influenced the story a lot in that direction and with that character. And I do have to say I've become really fond of that character after writing the book. He's really hit a place with me that I've enjoyed.
Wait, are we talking about Michael or?
Michael, I've been fond of Peter since I had the inspiration from him, for him. And I have had a lot of fun with that.
It's very good to hear all of this stuff because the book just it for a first novel, most people's first novels just aren't that great. Which is why I avoid writing them myself. But it like everything comes across really tight in this story. Like you kind of had an idea of where you wanted this to go and what you wanted to happen and how you wanted to present things, and you didn't let anything get in the way of the story. I'm not gonna lie, at the party when the vampires and the zombies showed up, that threw me for a loop.
That's it. As a more experienced author now, I can say that that's something I would probably do a little differently if I were writing the book over again. It does have a bit of a tonal shift at about that point. And, I'm going to chalk that up to a neophyte mistake and, try and do better on future stories.
Yeah, like I say, it wasn't bad. It was just one of those things where, you know, this book has been rolling along and it's been kind of a mystery story, and he's been fighting this this Serna demon, and trying to figure out where it came from and what it's trying to do to him and how to get rid of it. And then, like, that happens and now we're in an action movie.
Right, and that really is basically it. You're not the only person who's told me that, and you are correct. That's to me, that's the biggest flaw in the story, is that the first half of it is basically a mystery, and the second half of it is basically a thriller. And that's something that, with a bit more experience, I would have handled better. And I hopefully will be handled better in future installments. But... you know, I say that, and I still feel like the story came out fairly well with it. It just, that one bit is a little jarring, I guess.
Yeah, like I don't necessarily want to use the word clunky, because it wasn't. It just kind of, yeah, jarring is a better word for it. It didn't exactly, like, once you read the rest of the story and you find out what has been happening in the background of, you know, his mystery of the Serna demon. It all makes sense, and, you know, it comes across very well, taking everything into context. But just reading it through the first time, getting to that part, it's like, oh, this is what we're doing now. Okay, I better just buckle in, because I'm just gonna be there's surprises coming in the future, because this has completely thrown off the tone of the novel, and changed it into something different, not badly. It's not a bad different. It's just, like, we're not doing the mystery anymore.
Right. And that's definitely something I've learned from, and will, you know, try to tighten down in the future. So I've got two sequels in the works for this one. The one of them follows Peter. You've read the end, so you know that they kind of part ways at the end. One of them follows Peter and one follows Michael. And the one following Peter is basically done, and is due out in December. And that one, I can say, does not have a tonal consistency problem. It's a straight up thriller all the way through. So.
Should I go and read the short stories about Peter before I read this new one that's coming out, or can I jump into second book and just be okay?
In fact, you'll be able to jump into that one completely standalone. It was written for that intentionally, but it does more or less immediately pick up Peter right after the end of War Demons. So a few months have passed as he's been, as you know, he's gone on a bit of a hunt at the end.
Yeah.
So there's been a few months of hunting going on, and then it picks up where he's found his quarry and continues from there. And it is pretty much a straight up action story, but I had a lot of fun writing that one. Hopefully the readers will have a lot of fun reading it.
I'm looking forward to it, because Peter wound up being my favorite character in the book, because Michael has he has all of these problems with PTSD and alcoholism and being haunted by the ghosts of his past, and Peter is a rock. He is just which I imagine there's some symbolism in the name.
a little bit
of biblical symbolism there.
A little bit of beat you over the head symbolism. Sorry.
No, it wasn't that. Like, I just thought of that while I'm kind of reasoning all of this out loud. I didn't get it while I was reading the story, so it's, you know, it's not that you buried the lead. It's just I was too dumb to pick up on it. But yeah, he was just like an emotional rock. He had very rigid principles that he abided by. He knew what he was doing in just about every scene, even if he didn't know what was going on. If he had to follow orders, then he followed orders. When he had to act on his own, then he acted like an intelligent person. He wasn't just some dumb kid. And one of my big likes about Peter's character was that he specifically avoided going home with, like, the girls at the college that kind of slept around, and he found Faith and he liked her. And then, you know, that whole dynamic between those two characters, it didn't get a lot of screen time, so to speak, air quotes, but That was one of my favorite parts of the book, was that he wanted a chaste kind of traditional woman, and Faith really liked him, and there was that one part in the book where she wants him too, and you know, she wants to be better for him, and that kind of character development and that kind of worldview is not something that I see in fiction a lot. And Peter wound up being a very, very heroic character, just through his interactions with Michael and Faith and the Vatican Special Forces.
Well, I'm also really glad to hear that, because I have to admit that I struggled pretty hard with a lot of that, because Peter's a very difficult character in some ways. I really love the character, but he's very difficult to write because he's a very goody-goody character in a lot of ways.
Yeah, he really, like everything really you just is. Described.
And so it's very hard to... It was very difficult to pull that off without just making him sound like a dork.
I think you accomplished it very well, because Peter kind of came off as not exactly a prude, but, excuse me, as somebody who knew what he wanted and would not compromise. You know, he didn't sound like a dork. He didn't sound like a church geek or anything like that. He, like I say, he knew what he wanted, and he wasn't about to compromise, even when all of these girls are throwing themselves at him.
Right, and that was what I was after, but it was not easy to pull off in the writing, because it's so easy for a character like that just to be like, I have to agree, some of the stuff with him and Faith was some of my favorite parts of the book as well. I still cackle every time I think about him carrying her out of the frat house and her
I remember that.
Somewhat intoxicated ramblings. I just laugh every time I think about it, and really enjoyed that. Vigil, the follow-up that's coming out in December, really is a lot about the two of those two characters. That's another reason I had quite a bit of fun with it, was putting them back together in some of those situations and I also had a bit of fun with that, because one of the things in War Demons, they have a relationship that's very undeveloped, because they barely know each other.
Yeah, and it kind of feels like Peter is, like, he likes her, but he's more trying to rescue her because it's the right thing to do, rather than, you know, I love this woman, you know, I would sacrifice my life for her. It's, no, she's in trouble, and I have to go and help her.
Right, and so some of the fun parts of Vigil was giving Peter a reason to decide, okay, I actually kind of like this girl. And so I had some fun with that, and enjoyed working on that a good bit. And hopefully the readers will have a lot of fun with that one too. That one also is different in a sense that I had the concept for that one pretty much right from the beginning and knew where it was going, like the whole thing. I don't know. I kind of had that scene. Have you ever seen the Boondock Saints?
Oh, God. Like 40 times.
So, you know that bit at the beginning where the guys are just, there's a mass going on, and they come into the church and they're just walking up and just in the middle of mass, and they're getting blessed, and then they're going off, you know, ready to rock.
Yeah. And all of the people are like, who the heck are these guys? And, you know, the church staff really don't react to them, because they kind of know what's going down here.
Yeah, so Vigil just kind of has that feel throughout the whole story.
Oh, that's awesome, because that was a really, really powerful scene in that movie.
It's I don't know if you've heard the description of it before, but Vigil is essentially Peter has to rescue Faith from a dragon underneath a church on Easter Sunday during the Easter Vigil Mass. and it's about as insane as that sounds, and I had a ridiculous amount of fun with it. And The atheists in the audience are probably not bothered by any of that. For the Catholics who think it might be problematic, I actually have had a priest read it and he loved it. So,
At least you're getting it vetted by church staff first.
don't take that as an endorsement from the church because I don't have that officially, but I did have a priest read it. He thought it was great. So, you know, it has managed to pull that off, which was that was a difficult line to ride on that one of like, okay, I want to make this awesome and I also don't want to go to hell.
Well, I really reading it, I don't really think you have anything to worry about because like the material is handled so respectfully in War Demons, like it's obvious where you're coming from as the writer, but at the same time you're not beating the atheists over the head with it, you know. There's I don't remember a single dumb atheist joke in the entire book.
No, and I you know, I will probably have a few of those throughout the series, and they will probably be equally matched by some dumb Christian jokes because I've known plenty of both. And the reality is most people really are idiots, no matter what their beliefs in life are.
Yeah, but like I said, none of the Christian stuff, the Catholic stuff really bothered me at all because it was A, it was handled respectfully and I don't see a lot of people doing that, and B, it wasn't overbearing, it was presented as part of the world,
Right.
not something that you're in. So it's not like reading the Left Behind series.
No, I will say for those who worry about that, Vigil, by the nature of the story, is a bit more overtly Christian. Is probably one of the most overtly Christian stories the series will have. But the nature of the story, even beyond what I've already described, kind of required that. And it wasn't, that was the other thing that was difficult, was trying to do that story without just going too far over the top in that direction. And hopefully I pulled that off, but that was much more challenging in that one than it was in War Demons. Just because of the nature of it. There's a reason they're fighting during mass. And of course, because the story wouldn't be very fun if it didn't, everything totally blows up in their face and goes wrong while they're doing that. So, it's you know, again, by its nature, it just kind of had to go a bit that more that way. But I also think that the people who read the story will understand why the story required that and not take it too much as a trying to beat anybody over the head with that.
I really, really wouldn't worry. Like, this is War Demons is a book that I would recommend to my atheist, Christian, Buddhist, you know, Taoist friends. I'm not entirely certain that I have any of, you know, all of those different demographics, but I would recommend the book to anybody because it's a fun story, and the religion is there to serve the story. And like I say, by serving the story, you serve the religion more so than if you had just written this, you know, 400 page preach fest, just a 400 page sermon.
Well, and that's, you know, I've got to be straight up honest with you. This was one of the things, and one of the reasons that led me to do it is most overtly Christian fiction these days really sucks. Like, it's just bad. It's
I'm
really
not going to
terrible.
disagree with you.
It's really, really bad. And it doesn't have to be. It's like, come on. And it's mostly what you say. It's mostly exactly what you say. They're beating you over the head with it. And that's not fun, even if you are Christian. It's like, come on, I want to have a good story. And then you get into stuff. This is something I took very seriously in the story as well. Like, there's a lot of Christian stuff that just wants to pretend that there are no actual bad people in the world, or even that good people don't do bad things. But they do. And even good Christian people do bad things. And, you know, and that's honestly part of the Christian worldview, right? That we're all sinners. Trying to hide that and cover it up, or just, oh, he did this bad thing, so now he's evil and we shun him. That doesn't make a good story. And it's no fun.
Because to my understanding, in Christian theology, we're all fallen, and we're going to screw up, even if we do follow Christ and follow God, and we do everything we can to live our lives right, we're going to mess up. But that's what the forgiveness is there for. That's why you can go in Catholicism, you can go and confess your sins and pray the rosary and get forgiveness for the bad things that you've done. You're not a hopeless case.
Exactly. And that's, you know, as you know from reading the story, Michael, the main character, that's actually a big part of his struggle. He's far from an angel. he's done some not so great things in his life, and a lot of them he's very well aware of. And, you know, trying to somewhat atone for. And but of course,
and that, by the way, comes across in the story very well. Very well. Michael is a great character. He's very well written.
But at the same time, despite his own conversion in the time period that's happened, he's not perfect yet either. In fact, he's a little bit of an asshole.
As a matter of fact, I think I would probably like Michael less if he were perfect. Because this is a guy with,
right.
You know, like, I've never been in the military. I don't have PTSD or anything like that. But so far as, like, you know, like alcoholism and things that you've done in your past that keep you up at night and things like that, those are struggles that I can identify with and I can understand and to an extent identify with his search for meaning, answers, and forgiveness for the bad things that he's done through Catholicism.
Right. And that's the thing is, you know, whether you're Christian or Buddhist or Catholic or whatever, like you said, those are the things we all struggle with. We've all done things we look back at and we're like, man, I really wish I hadn't done that. And yeah, it's universal. It's just part of the human condition. We all fight that and struggle with it on a daily basis. And God knows, there's things I've done in my life that I really wish I hadn't done that. It's the part we identify with, and also the part our former priest at our parish is fond of saying. He's like, the problem with us, the problem we face as Christians isn't that we hate our sins. It's just the problem is we love our sins. and the point from a writing perspective is like the sinful parts are the parts that make the story fun. You know, so you don't want to throw those out because that's what makes it interesting. But at the same time, given the theology and the background and cosmology of where I'm trying to present the story from, it's also generally presented as, okay, yeah, I did that, and maybe it was fun, but that was bad. I shouldn't have done that.
And one of the things that I really liked about Michael in particular is that he has not forgiven himself. Like, he understands
right.
on an intellectual level that, you know, God forgives him of his sins and things like that, but he has to work on forgiving himself for the bad things that he's done, and that's more what his kind of personal journey throughout the story is about. He has to learn to look back on those things and go, yeah, I did it, but you know,
it really is, and
he admits that it was all his fault. There's a huge level of personal responsibility in this story that I really enjoy. Like, he did it. There was that one thing about him being drugged, but he still went and did it. You know, he still went and did it, and he can't forgive himself for it. And
he still went and did it. And at the beginning of the story, he doesn't know that either. So, I mean, he doesn't realize that's what happened.
And finding out that that was what happened didn't allow him to absolve himself.
No, and it also, it opened up a whole new can of worms for him. because that was a pretty, that's a pretty shocking thing to suddenly find out after the fact of, all this stuff has happened to me. That then he has to work through as well. And that was, I'll say this, One of the things I figured out about Peter Bishop very early on, I do have the two short stories out there that I'd already written, and I figured this out in the first one and definitely carried it through to the second one. And this actually was the moment when I really finally understood what War Demons was about when I was writing it, and was when I realized. So I figured out a long time ago that every Peter Bishop story, the actual story is really about all this action stuff is going on. He's fighting all this stuff. There's monsters. But the real story is actually about Peter Bishop saving somebody's soul. And I, you know, it's like, it's not obvious. It's not always in your face. And like, if you looked at it from like a plot outline, that may not even show up in the plot line anywhere, but that's really ultimately what the story is about. And when I realized, wait a minute, I'm writing a Peter Bishop story, and the soul to be saved in this book is Michael's, is when I really understood the book. And I'm like, okay, I know where this book is going now. And I know what it has to do, and I know where all the characters are. And that was basically the eureka moment that brought it all together.
That comes across very well because at a certain point in the story, Peter does kind of take over, but not in the sense that, every chapter is about him. There's still all of this stuff going on in the background, but at a certain point in the story, it just kind of smoothly transitions from Michael's story about dealing with all of his personal demons, as well as trying to save the world from a dragon, to Peter kind of coming into his own and becoming the guy, like not like th basically the chosen one.
And that was one of the other things I figured out too, as well, that I actually really loved. And I'm writing the actual direct sequel to this book now, the follow-on that stars Michael. And as I was writing it, my original plan was not to have very much Peter in it. As soon as I finish this trilogy, Peter's going to be getting his own series of books next, but I want to finish this trilogy first and get it done. And of course, they're both going to be guest appearing in each other's works, but originally Peter was not going to be in the sequel very much. And then I kind of realized these characters are a lot more fun when they're together. Because
They
they
play
have a
off of each
very
other very well.
they do they have a very Superman and Batman thing going on with each other. They're both on the right side of things, but the way they approach it is very different. And they accentuate each other very much by being together, and they both become more fun. And so it is the sequel is still definitely Michael's book, not Peter's, but Peter is in it a lot more than I had originally planned on, and it's a good thing that he is. It's turning out much better this way.
Another thing that I had noticed about this book that I was really honestly just grateful for while I was reading it was the presentation of gender dynamics, not just between men and women, but between women and women and men and men. Like the scene when they're in the bar and the foreign exchange student Khalid is there and he's the son of an oil sheik and all of the women are all over him because he's the biggest dog on the dominance hierarchy, and he gets into a confrontation with Michael, and Michael's like, "Yeah, I went to war, and it's not really a big deal." And then Khalid keeps pushing it, and Michael just shows off his helicopter scar.
I had a lot of fun writing that scene as well, and I enjoyed that one. And yeah, that was one of the things I put some effort into, and I'll leave it to readers to judge how well it came across. But I don't think a lot of books handle gender dynamics very accurately, or very well. I think you have a lot of one of two things. You either find gender dynamics kind of idealized, oh, the White Knight goes and save the lady, and now everybody's happy. She's all pedestalized, and he's all perfect. Or you find the exact opposite, where the SJWs get into the picture and just treat everybody as if they're absolutely horrible, and everybody's evil. And in reality, people are very complicated. And Terry Pratchett, the wonderful, fantastic late Sir Terry Pratchett, made one of the best quotes in one of his books. I don't even remember. Good Omens, I think it was. The problem with people is not that they're fundamentally good or fundamentally evil. It's that they're fundamentally people. And, they are. People are just, they're very complicated, and men and women both. And, we're not always, we like to pretend we're rational, but we're mostly really not. And,
That is a big problem that you will notice if you just spend like a day on Twitter.
right, exactly. You cannot spend any time on Twitter without noticing how rational people are not. And that was part of what I the, that scene in particular, a lot of it was, trying to play off of, like, look, most of the people in this scene are not reacting rationally at all. They're just acting the way people do in this kind of situation. And you have this situation where you have the basically the big rich kid and good looking rich kid, and all the women love him and all the guys hate
Except for the one guy
him.
who thinks he's going to get laid by glomming on to his
Right.
personality.
And there is always that guy. There's always that guy, and all the other guys hate him. And it's just so real. I've seen that so many times happen. And then you do have cases like in the particular that particular scene, you have cases where that guy will latch on to somebody to basically pick a fight in order to establish his dominance. And that scene was fun because he just latched on to the wrong person.
And the great part about that scene was that Michael wasn't there to impress anybody. Like, that was the
Right.
farthest thing from his mind. He was just there to have a drink with his friends from college and, hang out. And then this guy starts something with him, and, you really, really don't want to start things with an Afghani war vet.
No, not usually. And so yeah, it was I had a lot of fun writing that scene as well. That was some parts of that book were a slog to write, and other parts were very fun and just came out very easily. And that was one of the parts that came out pretty easily. So.
Well, the whole book was fun to write, but one of the things that really got me, and we might be getting into mild spoiler territory here, was how Michael and Abigail kind of interacted over the course of the story after her big secret comes out and you find out what kind of person she really is. And I'm not gonna say that her character was shallow, because there are people like that in the world. Like, that's one of the things that, oh, this character is shallow, this is, this is unrealistic. Well, no, there are people out there that actually are that shallow and have those kind of base motivations, even if they're doing the most monstrously evil things you could imagine.
Right. And that was actually part of my intention with her, was exactly that. Like, I had one of my beta readers was like, that's it, that's her motivation. And I was like, yeah, that's it. Because I've never seen somebody do anything quite that terrible from such a poor motivation personally. But I've seen people do some pretty terrible things from not much more motivation than that at all. And particularly when they come from that kind of a background, the spoiled little rich girl kind of background, it's is when that really does you take. And that was actually one of the other points I wanted to make with it, is that we like to look at the world and think that these really horrible evil things that we see come from a place of, well, something terrible and horrible must have happened to this person, right? We want to explain things that way and look at it, but the honest reality is that sometimes people do really evil things for no good reason.
Yeah.
Or for a reason that maybe is a reason, but it's really just totally disproportionate to what they're doing. And it's real. And it really happens. And sometimes it's that stupidly simple. And yeah, there's a level at which that's not always very satisfying, but
Like, I mean, if you want to look at it from like a literary perspective, quote unquote, yeah, it's simplistic and it's kind of one-dimensional, but at the same time, like we were talking about earlier, there are people out there that are that simplistic and one-dimensional, and not every book has to be, this amazing dissertation on the vagaries of the human condition. Some people are just kind of dumb and evil because they're dumb.
yeah. And this was very much a case too of purposefully wanting to actually show that, you know what, sometimes really people go that evil for really stupid reasons. And I have seen it. I see a lot of the worst evil we really deal with in the real world, 'cause there's some pretty evil things happening in this book. But
Yeah.
most of us don't deal with evil on that kind of scale in our real lives. But we deal with evil. And we deal with it almost every day. But it's in the small things. And
Yeah,
that's
or sometimes even not so small things, like not to side rail us with politics, but like the thing that's been going around Twitter today. We're recording this on Sunday the 8th. That thing that's been going around Twitter today about the guy who got knowingly transmitting HIV to another person in the state of California decriminalized. It's like a
right.
parking ticket. It's a misdemeanor now. Like, that's legitimately evil.
Right. You're legitimately giving somebody a deadly disease is legitimately evil. And but somebody didn't do that from a perspective of evil. I mean, you go and you look at the motivation for all these people, and you're like, well, we don't want to be treated like we're evil just because we have this disease. Well,
Okay,
okay,
that's fine,
I
just
get
don't
that,
just
but you're
accept
ending
that
up
you
in a
have it and don't give it
you're
to other
ending up
people.
right. You're ending up in a place that is legitimately evil when you're trying to give that disease to some when you're consciously choosing to give that disease to somebody else. You're ending up in a place that's legitimately evil.
Yeah, that's one of my
And
big problems with Freddie Mercury, because the entire song Bohemian Rhapsody is like the first part of that song is I had AIDS, or was it HIV or AIDS? I can't remember which one he had, but the lyrics of Bohemian Rhapsody are about him having sex with another man and knowingly transmitting this disease to him and basically killing the guy in the process, and him kind of dealing with how evil that is. And I love Queen, I love Freddie Mercury, but that's just one of those things that's damn near unforgivable. Like, you're gonna have to do some serious charity work to make up for that one, dude.
It's my turn to be the dumb listener because I never caught that in the song. I'm gonna have to go check the lyrics now, and that's I believe you that it's there. I never caught that before, and I don't know that I love that song.
The
And I
whole
don't know that
mama
I can
just
listen to
killed a
it anymore.
man, put a gun against his head, pulled my trigger, now he's dead. Mama, life had
Right.
just begun. Now I've gone and thrown it all away. That whole thing.
I
Now,
get it.
I will say that I haven't heard that from an official source. That's just something that I've heard that's an interpretation of those lyrics. But given that
Right.
Freddie Mercury did have AIDS and he was
Was.
bisexual and he had sex with men,
And he was extremely promiscuous as well.
yeah, and it's not exactly a stretch.
No, it's not. It hurts sometimes when you realize what songs you really love, what they're actually about. It's painful. But yeah, you have that. And then you have stuff. It, Lord knows what they'll ever find is the actual motivation, but you have stuff like this Las Vegas shooting. And, you know, as far as I can see on any report that's out there, nobody has any clue what this guy's motive was.
Yeah, it just seems
You
like
know,
a random act of evil. Like the guy
and
brought however many guns up
yeah.
into this hotel room and then just started firing down into a crowd.
And everybody wants to find a motivation as, again, as the readers of this news entertainment that we get every day, we aren't satisfied with that answer. We're all like, there must be a reason. There's got to be something, but sometimes there isn't. You know, sometimes people just do evil things, and sometimes we really do it for no reason. And it's not satisfying at all, but it's also real. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe we'll find out that there was a different reason in this case. You know, but we don't always. Sometimes there's just not a reason that we can understand. It just happened.
Well, that was a serious downer.
Yeah, I killed the conversation. Sorry.
it might have been my fault, but that's one of the things that comes across in this novel very well, is that sometimes people just have bad motivations for why they want to perform evil acts, and sometimes it really just isn't more complicated than that. Sometimes evil is simple. There doesn't always have to be this
Right.
huge, like you give a backstory for the evil character and why they're doing what they're doing, and it's simple, yeah, but sometimes it's just not as complicated as people would like to imagine it to be. Sometimes people are just crazy and evil.
Yeah, and it is. I will say in this particular case with that particular character, there is a bit more to the story. And it's coming in some of the sequels. Her story's not done, but at the same time, there's more and there's not more. Like her motivation is that simple, and yeah,
But there is a story behind it.
there's a story behind it of how she got from that to, you know, everything that happened and the absolutely horrible things that happened, but the motivation at heart is still really pretty much that simple. You know, but I will say this, for the people who find it too simplistic, try the rest of the series and see what you think by the time you get to the end and find the whole story. Because even though you find the motivation simplistic, you may find that the story is not. If that makes sense.
So there will be some expanding on that character's past in
Oh
future
yes.
books.
Well, for one thing, in the next the direct sequel that I'm working on right now, working title on that is Spirit Cooking. You've read any you know how the story, how War Demons ends? You can make a fairly decent guess of where that story's going. And you're probably not wrong. For those in the audience who don't know what that term is, don't Google it at work.
Yeah, definitely do not Google spirit cooking at work.
Yeah, it's going into the seedy underbelly of the rich world.
Okay.
Which is funny because I just realized, given some of the other news going around this weekend, how much that fits as well. But also you kind of know how War Demons ends. It would not surprise you to imagine that there's a gigantic lawsuit in the making as well over large sums of money.
Yeah, that's about as far as we can get without dropping spoilers.
Yeah, I don't want to drop any massive spoilers, but the kind of things that happen in the end of that book don't happen in real life without lawsuits being
Yeah.
filed. And
And
that's
you make a point of that with, talk of lawyering up and things like that.
right. Yeah, and so that probably doesn't surprise anybody who's read the book to know that yeah, that's a major B plot in the next story is the several lawsuits actually or several trials, I should say, one law, one civil and one criminal involving a particular bad character. And they become very interesting subplots as part of the whole story.
Another thing that I noticed was I don't want to turn this into like anti-SJW diversity hour or anything like that, but there are varying different characters in this book of various diverse backgrounds. And it comes across so naturally. Like the character of Denzel. Denzel is a really, really tall black guy that goes to school with Michael and Peter. And he winds up being one of the most heroic characters in the entire book.
I loved Denzel. I loved writing him. I loved every bit of it. And I know people exactly like him.
I know a few like him as well.
And I just had a blast writing him. And the only thing that really disappointed me about Denzel was when I decided that I was going to strip the book of all the F-bombs, because I want to keep it fairly accessible. And
But I mean, it is. I mean, you're Catholic, and you're trying to get kind of Christian. It, like part of the point of this book really seemed to me to be, maybe it was unintentional, but it seemed to me to be able to, or sorry, let me back up. Part of the point of this book, and maybe it was unintentional, seemed to be to show, excuse me, show Christians how to write actually good fiction.
I don't know that the intent was to show people how to do it. The intent was to do it. but I also, because it does have the Christian overtones, I wanted it to be accessible to those Christian readers as well.
Right,
And I
so
was like,
dropping a lot
okay,
of F-bombs, and like, there is
the,
cursing in the book, but it's nothing particularly egregious, at least not
right.
by
And
my standards.
it was a case of, okay, the ones who are not going to accept any cursing wouldn't read this book anyway. But I was like, okay, I want to strip this out. I want it to be a PG-13 book, that, people don't mind if their teenagers are reading it.
And it doesn't come across as the intention. Like it doesn't, reading the book, it really doesn't seem like the intention of this book was to be like a PG-13 movie or anything like
No,
that.
and the first draft did have some F-bombs in it. And I don't know, are F-bombs allowed on your podcast? I don't want to overstep what.
Dude, I was about to ask you if it's okay if I curse.
So the original line is when Denzel, sees the dragon for the first time, and he's out there and he's like, man, nobody told me there was a motherfucking dragon here. And I hated stripping that line out because it was so true to the character. And
Well,
yet I was like, no, I gotta take it
I think
out.
with PG-13, you get like one F-bomb
Yeah.
that you can throw around. So use it wisely, and that would have been a very good use of it. I'm kind of sad that that line got pulled myself.
I have to sh for the folks who don't mind the language, I'll have to share it. That's the actual line that's really there in reality. I just had to, mildly censor the book.
Yeah. I
So
had the same problem with
that's what Denzel really said.
I had the same problem with the story that I sent off to Misha Burnett's 21st Century Thrilling Adventure anthology, is that these characters are not like chaste people. Like they
Right.
curse a lot. Like one guy's ex-military and he's not exactly clean slate or anything like that. So I had to go through that story and just change a lot of dialogue.
And honestly, I am not the person who's so religious that I don't curse. I don't care, and I watch tons of movies. And for the people in the audience who worry that it's been censored for religious reasons, no, it was censored for money reasons because PG-13 movies make a lot more money than rated R movies do. Yeah, I want my book to be more accessible so it makes me more money. That's why I pulled it out. It had nothing to do with the religious side, except that they're an audience I'm targeting. But yeah, I hated taking that out because it was just too much fun. And as far as the cursing goes, too, you know, it's the trope I have to be really careful of not overusing. But with the Peter Bishop character, who does borderline goody-goody character, is that that's also the running joke, is that you always know things are really bad when Peter curses.
Because he's such a good kid, and
It's the kid who never does. So when he's letting out a curse of any kind, you know it's really bad. You know, I had some fun with that as well.
maybe you can release a like an unedited version or something that keeps that line in.
You know, I may have to have. We'll see if this makes it into the final cut or not. But it may have to be the case that in the final Peter book, when you know everything really goes, that may be where the F-bomb appears.
Like I said, you're doing PG-13, you get one.
Oh my God! You know, like, and then his wife's over there looking at him like, you know, we've been married for how many years? I've never heard you say that ever. Like, how bad is it? But no, I loved Denzel, and his one moment of real heroism was fantastic, and that wasn't even planned. I got to a certain point in the story, and I was like, oh no, I totally know who's, you know, he just stepped up and was like, hey, I got this, guys,
And
and I
he
enjoyed
rushes
that.
in to take care of the problem.
He does, and it was I really enjoyed that a lot. But at the same time, I also, like you said, one of the things I hate about how SJWs approach the diversity is that they try to whitewash it. And I use that term very intentionally because you see so much SJW literature, and they're trying to make diverse characters sound like they're white and act like they're white. Like, they don't. You know, and it's not an intelligence thing. It's not putting anybody down. It's just the cultures are different and they don't act the same.
It's totally a cultural thing, you know. Somebody who was raised, you know, in a black neighborhood in Georgia is not going to talk like Michael,
No,
you know.
he's not. He's not going to talk like it at all. And I tried to handle that very lovingly because I very much loved the character. And he will be back. He's a minor character, and he will always be a minor character, but he'll be back more than once. Him and his friend George both. The
George, I liked George too. George felt a lot like Billy from the original Power Rangers series.
A little bit. And you know, he was the guy, you know, his moment of heroism came last, not surprisingly, because it's nearly last in the book, but it hit a certain point, and I was like, no, George has to be the one to do this and have his moment of glory, and his completely dorky moment of glory.
The guy that brought a hoe saw finally gets to step up and do something.
I'm just waiting for the day when anybody catches that reference. Nobody will ever catch it, but.
Is it like a horror movie reference or something? Because if you give me a hint, I might be
It's
able to get it.
it is actually a horror movie reference. It's from a very obscure, like, D level horror movie that probably nobody's ever seen.
Are we talking like Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter or like Black Devil Doll from Hell or Evil Bong or something?
Probably that obscure. Yeah, it's to the point where my brother, when he was in college, he and his girlfriend at the time, who's his wife now, they were visiting once, and they were like talking about this movie that some of their friends in college had been in, they'd put together. So it was like super indie, just dramatically low budget. It's honestly, it's a terrible movie. But it had some moments that were absolutely brilliant,
It can't
and
be
one of
as
them
bad as
was
Manos, the Hands of Fate.
it's not but it had some moments that were absolutely brilliant, like just brilliant, in the midst of a pretty terrible movie. And the Hosaw moment was one of them.
You're gonna
it
have
got.
to like DM me the name of this movie so that I can go and try and look it up, because I really
Yeah,
want to see
I'll
this
send it
one
to
now.
you. I don't want to ruin it for anybody in the audience because, I can't give away the answer. Someday somebody will actually catch the reference and it'll be glorious. Yeah, it's just be warned if you go watch it. It really is not a good movie. But it does actually have legit moments of it's one it's you know it's made by a bunch of college kids, so it
So
has
it's
moments of real brilliance, but they it's their first movie, they didn't know what they were doing.
not quite as good as Evil Dead, but
No, but it really does have some moments, some great gags in it. So yeah, I had fun with that, and those two characters are going to be back for quite some time. They're in the series for the long run, in both series, crossing over into both worlds, and just the kind of characters who show up every now and then.
That was another thing that was really refreshing about this book, because like I say, before I found like the Pulp Revolution and stuff like that, I had been listening to a lot of mainstream science fiction podcasts like Clark's World and the Escape Artists guys and people like that, and a lot of the stories kind of devolved along racial lines at a certain point. And that never once happened in War Demons, and that was very refreshing. Like there was no, like Denzel never had his black power moment or anything like that. It was just people interacting normally, which if you look at like the news, you're going to get this idea of America that it's this horribly racially divided, society. But then you actually go out and interact with people that live in America, and race relations are actually, pretty decent if you get away from like huge population centers.
Well, and I gotta say this, because I live in the South, and the book is set in Athens, Georgia, and I lived there for 4 years. I went to the University of Georgia for a year. I did a third of my master's degree there. Circumstances forced me to finish it somewhere else, but I set the book there, and I live in Alabama right now. And in the media, we're presented as a, just anytime there's race problems, they're always pointing straight to the South, right? And there are some here, okay? And there are definitely parts of the South that are really bad. There are parts of it that are really not.
Yeah,
But if
for example, after that shooting that went down in South Carolina, my home state, in Charleston, where I don't remember the officer's name, but he shot a guy in the back while he was running away. He shot a black guy. And this was on the heels, like directly on the heels of Ferguson and Baltimore and, all of these huge race riots that had gone down. And that happened, and the cop was definitively in the wrong. Like they had body cam footage of him just, unjustly firing on this guy. And the race baiters, I guess is a good way to put it. The Black Lives Matter people, they came down here and they made this big stink about it. But like everybody in South Carolina told them to basically just get fucked. Leave. We don't need you here. We're not about to burn down Charleston because the cop is being punished. Like he's being prosecuted for this crime that he committed. Everything's fine. Like race relations in South Carolina and to an extent Georgia and North Carolina and places like that. Below the Mason-Dixon line, race relations are actually pretty good for the most part.
Right,
And
there's
it blows my mind that people will look at the South and go, y'all are completely and horribly, utterly racist backwoods hicks. And then, something bad happens like in Baltimore, and they just have these huge riots and people are
Right.
burning stuff in the streets and, none of that happens around here.
Well, and here's the thing. My wife's grandfather is the one who phrased it this way, and I think he totally nailed it. Here in the South, we've lived together for a long time. You go outside the South, and the African American populations outside of the South are all relatively new. It's the folks who have migrated out in the last 50, 60 years. In fairness, a lot of them were getting away from Jim Crow and a lot of the horrible things that were going on here. But down here, we've lived together for a long time, and things aren't perfect by any means, but there's also a case where we've kind of figured out how to just make it work.
Yeah, no, I my last job, I worked with a succession of black women, and there was never a problem. Like, they would make fun of me for being a white boy, and I would go along with it because, let's be honest, white people can be fucking stupid sometimes.
They can.
But it never devolved into that kind of racial. Like, they would look at the stuff that I was looking at on Twitter every day and think that it was just as insane as I thought it was. Like, we would get into serious conversations about, like, welfare and Section 8 housing and, even gentrification and stuff like that, and they were agreeing with me, and my opinions on the matter were pretty, like, not exactly mainstream Republican, but farther to the right than you would expect, your average black person to be.
And it's so you see that, and I just tried to reflect, what my experience has actually been with those characters of, I see race relations devolve around here sometimes too. I see that, witness it firsthand occasionally, but I also see cases like this where, in this case, you have the gigantic, huge, black kid who was literally, a lot of his backstory is not in the book yet. More of it'll be coming out, but he was literally raised on a farm. And, his family sent him to school because the University of Georgia has one of the best agriculture programs around, right? And his tall, gangly, skinny, nerdy, redheaded roommate, who, and their interaction of these two guys being great friends, and I've seen things like this in person, where it just, it defies the stereotypes, but I've seen it happen too, and they're, to me, the two of them together are hilarious. So,
Well, that's the thing, is that, people look at the bad stuff that happens, and that creates our internal heuristic that we judge things by. Our preconceived notions and stereotypes are created by the big fire, not the 200 years of this never having happened. And I'm just talking about, like, let's take this meadow that hasn't had a brush fire in 200 years. Nobody notices the 200 years of brush fire, or of peaceful meadow. They notice the brush fire that happened. So, you don't really see a lot of reporting on all of the just people, like I said, at my last job, I'm a white guy. I worked with two black women, and we got along just fine. That doesn't make news coverage because it's not exciting. So people tend to get this idea of, oh, race relations are totally horrible in the South. It really gets blown out of proportion because they're not seeing the average day-to-day of white people and black people just existing in the same space and getting along perfectly fine.
And to me, this is actually one of the big problems our culture faces right now is, I'm going to call it media bias, but people are going to take that the wrong way, because what I don't mean like liberal media bias. I believe that's real too, but I don't actually think that's the bigger problem. I think the bigger problem is sensationalism bias. If it bleeds, it leads. And anything that's not sensational never makes the news, and it's totally warped. Anybody who lives too much on the news, your view of reality is totally warped by that now, because the sensational stuff is maybe 1% of what actually happened in a day-to-day life of anybody. Maybe 1%. I don't know about your life, but my life is pretty boring most of the time, and so is everybody else's. You don't hear about any of that,
Well,
you don't hear
I'm a
about
shut-in, so I'm a bad example, but.
But that's the reality, is that, you don't hear about any of the stuff that's not boring. For the weather analogy, it was bright and sunny and beautiful 300 days this year, but that's not what you hear about. You hear about the hurricane. And, it's fine. It makes sense to a point until you get to the spot where your view of reality in every sense is totally skewed by this. And I don't know that I have much more to say on it than that, but it just does. It's totally distorts what people believe.
But to wrap up that part, I'll just say that it was very refreshing to see kind of race relations portrayed in this book as they actually are, rather than how people would imagine them to be. Because there's this comic book out that I found out about recently called Black. And the writer, their first name, and I wish I was joking, is Kwanzaa. But it's about, like, in a world that already hates them. What if only black people had superpowers? And it's just this crazy fever dream of imagined racism all over the, like, cops just shoot black kids for sport and things. It's completely insane. Nurkish has done a couple of good videos on the Black comic, but like that kind of sensationalism sells. But the actual reality of things is a whole lot more toned down than people would believe it to be. And I appreciate you bringing that kind of not into the spotlight, because it's not made a serious point in the book. It's just these people interact like regular humans, like they treat each other like people, and none of this is ever made a big deal of, and that's honestly how the day-to-day is for a lot of people.
Well, and that's really what I was going after is, honestly, I just wanted some guys who represented kind of the typical college kids that I knew when I was there. And I felt like their addition, those characters in particular, their addition to the story, the purpose they served was to have some just regular people there.
They also did a good job as comic relief.
Yeah, and the story needed a little bit of that because it got pretty serious at points, so it needed a little comic relief. And like I said, to me, those two characters together are just hysterical.
Oh yeah, they deserve a buddy cop movie or something. Okay, so we took a short break, and we are joined by Russell's wife, Morgan Newquist. So, hi, Morgan.
Hi. I had no idea I was doing this, but I will just kind of go with
So I wanted to talk to you for a minute about Silver Empire Publishing,
Sure.
because this is one of these one of the new publishing houses that's coming out. That's it's not as well established as like Castalia House or Bain, but you're out there doing your own thing. You're publishing a magazine, I believe, right?
Kind of. We run a subscription short story service called Lioness. We put out a short story every week to our subscribers, science fiction and fantasy.
Okay, and you've published several books. So, what's kind of your overarching ethos, I guess, with Silver Empire? Is it like specifically meant to be like a subversive press kind of thing, or?
Well, I guess the way that I would phrase it is when we got into it, we weren't so much dead set on everything we published having to be superversive using the term, but we also feel like there are enough publishers out there who are being subversive these days, and so we didn't really necessarily need to do that. So the short version is we kind of started out with the publisher because we're like, we just looked at it from a business perspective. This isn't the first business we've run. And we kind of figured, well, we have all these costs if we start publishing books. And if we amortize it over more books, it has a much higher return on investment. And the best way to get more books is to bring in other people. So to us, it just kind of made sense as a way to go rather than going it alone. So that was the main reason we got started. And I would say that as we've gotten into it, our motivation, I guess, is evolving and changing in our approach to everything. And I don't want to co-opt anybody's terms, especially Superversive these days since they're running their own press. But honestly, these days we're really looking into more of a pulp model in general, both in terms of the kinds of stories we want to put out and also in terms of our actual business model. You're actually the very first person to hear this, Jim.
You did a special
You get a
announcement.
special announcement that we're gonna be rolling out some of this soon, but one thing that's coming down the line is we're about to ramp up production pretty heavily. It's not all going up at once, but
Well, I mean,
we're gonna.
Lioness is a weekly thing. It seems like that's pretty heavy into the
Right.
production side of things.
It is, but we're also. I mean, one short story a month isn't really.
A week.
Or a week, sorry, one short story a week's not really a whole lot more than your typical magazine's dealing with. We're between now and the end of the year, we're going to have one book a month out, and that production level is going to be ramping up again even more in January. And I'm not sure where we'll get to by the end of next year, but we're about to ramp up production rather a lot. We have some big announcements coming about exactly what, and we'll be rolling those out over the next few weeks and months. But
Are you getting like Brian Niemeyer and John C. Wright and
those specific names, no. Unfortunately, I would not cry about having either one of them on board. But both of those gentlemen are actually pretty happy with where they're at, as far as I know. If they're listening and I'm wrong, they both know how to contact me. And if either one of them has an interest, then I'm ready to listen. We do have several other people we have contacted though directly, and we want to let some other things play out, but probably within the next month or two, we'll also be opening up some direct submissions. We have very specific guidelines of what we're looking for, but within those, we're really looking to ramp up the production line a lot. So, very much in line with the old school pulp philosophy. We just actually think that's the way the business is headed at the moment with Amazon running everything.
Lots of content, lots of books.
Lots of content, lots of books. We think it's the way to go. And so there you go. You're the first one to hear it.
I'm grateful to have the scoop. Can we get a like a couple of name drops, maybe? Is it anybody that we would know?
Yes.
You would, yes, your listeners may or may not. Basically,
We haven't signed.
we're in talks with a bunch of
Yeah.
people and nothing is signed, which is why there's no announcements yet. But we're in
Okay.
we're quite a good ways along with several authors at the moment, and we have a few more we're going to be reaching out to, and so I can't drop any names yet, but I can say that it's all going very well at the moment, and we're very excited about what we're discussing with everybody, and hopefully our readers will be excited by it as well when they hear the news.
I know that I am. I wanted to get in on the Lioness thing, but I did not have the money at the time. I'm looking to buy a subscription here in the near future. But what I've heard about the stories that are coming out of Lioness and just the books that you guys are writing, like for example, Declan Finn has been posting a lot of reviews of his work, and he's getting very, very good marks. So, or at least from what I understand, I haven't gone and looked at the guy's Amazon page, but the blurbs from reviews that he's been releasing through his Twitter account have been very encouraging. And if you're publishing work that's on that kind of quality, then I'm very excited about where this is going to be going. And just like let me know when you guys release some more stuff. We can have you back on the podcast, or I can release a post on the website or something like that, try and get you some more readers.
We'd love to, and I can tell you, I can tell you everything we've got coming from now till the end of the year. So at the very end of this month, really kind of bleeding over the beginning of November, our next release is going to be a collection of superhero stories.
I had heard about that. I had heard about that, and it looked very interesting.
We just got the cover Thursday? The finalized version of it, I guess we just got on Friday. We've gotten confirmation from all the authors. We have our final lineup of it. We're putting it together now. I'm really excited about that one. I can tell you some of the authors who are in that. We have a story from John Della Rose, who just also got picked up to do the novelization of Alt Hero by Castalia House. We have a story by Kaiwai Chia. We've got
I've been referring to him as Benjamin Che in the podcast.
Right.
I'm not certain how to pronounce the guy's name, and he's never corrected me, so
I'm not either, and if he's listening and wants to correct me, he also knows how to contact me. I don't know how to pronounce his name, but I know that all of his work is amazing.
We've had two of his short stories in Lioness. They were really good.
They're probably two of the best we have. They are two of the best we have. I would say probably two out of the three best we've published myself. They're phenomenally good. And his story in our superheroes anthology is great. We have a story from my wife Morgan, who's here. We've got another story from Declan Finn in there. We've got you were talking about race relations earlier. We've got one in there that we just thought was fantastic from that perspective, and I don't want to say much more about it than that at all. But it was great.
We specifically advertised submissions for this one that there were no Captain America is actually Hydra type
right.
stories allowed.
We're never Hydra all the way.
Thank God. Because that's one of the big problems nowadays with just like literature in general, but comic books in particular, is that the people that are writing these superhero stories nowadays from the big outlets that traditionally publish superhero stories like DC and Marvel are just the people that are writing them do not seem to understand superheroes, which is why I blew my lid when I read My Hero Academia and watched the show, because it actually took the subject matter seriously. It felt like I was reading an old Spider-Man comic or an old Captain America comic. So yeah. if your stories in this anthology are more in the vein of actual heroes doing heroic deeds, then I'm very excited about this, and I can't wait to get my hands on a copy.
Yeah, we were very particular about that. I haven't seen My Hero Academia, although that's gravitated to our short list because everybody else seems to love it. But that was our specific submission outline, and our criteria, we rejected a number of them for not meeting it, is that we wanted stories about actual superheroes, not all this modern trying to put a new twist on it and all this and deconstructing it. We wanted some honest to God actual superheroes. And I think that the folks who are looking for that will be really happy with what we've put together.
That's why it's called Paragons.
That's right. The title is Paragons, and that is official launch date for that. We're looking at November 1st, so that'll be out really soon. Like I said, we're getting it together, and I'm extremely excited about it. Our next one after that, that'll be out by the end of November, is another anthology. It is collected short stories. So we put out a theme. I don't know if you've seen the new modern internet urban legend about, creepy random stairs in the woods that have cropped up.
I did hear about this
and
through various people that I follow on Twitter.
And you know, we just thought this is great. And so we started by reaching out to some of our writer friends, and we're just like, hey, we'd really love to see what a bunch of science fiction and fantasy and mystery and horror writers would do to actually explain this weird scenario. And then our submission page for it kind of went viral, and we're still combing through those because we had more submissions for that one anthology than we've had for every other anthology we've ever published put together.
I'm actually disappointed that I missed this one, because when I found out about it, the submissions were already closed, and the concept had synapses firing in my brain, and I wanted to do a story for it, but... You know, exactly. I just kind of bowed out and then let people know that it was coming.
And that seems to be what's happened. We've had, I had one writer in particular who literally, I sent him something inviting him to join us, and he sent me a draft that day of the story. Wow. And that's what's happened with all of our writers. They've seen the concept and they've just gone, oh man, I have to write this now. I had another writer, I won't name him here yet, but a Dragon Award nominated author. I watched him on Facebook. He's a friend of mine, but we didn't invite him at the time, because when we first started it, we didn't know him all that well, and he stumbled on it organically, and I watched him on Facebook complaining, because he's like, I have to drop everything and write this story right now. So that's the kind of thing we've gotten from it, and we're really excited about that one. That one's going to be called Secret Stairs, and it's coming out at the end of November, and I may have to pull up my calendar to see the release date we're targeting for that.
We have a real release calendar now. It's really cool.
Yeah, we're looking at the 29th of November for the release date on that, so at the end of the month. And then in December... As I've already mentioned, we're putting out Vigil, one of the kind of dual sequels to War Demons. First draft of that is done, and it's sitting with... so I can say I've brought on Brian Niemeyer as an editor. He's editing the book for me right now. I'm waiting to hear back from him, and then we'll be banging out the final draft of that and putting it out.
From what I understand, Brian's a very good editor, so I have no doubts that it's going to be amazing.
This is my first experience working with him in that capacity, but Brian has been a terrific friend and ally to us for a long time now, and I'm glad to work with him in this sense. I'm very, very excited about how that's coming out. And then we will also be in – I can talk a little bit about what's coming in January and beyond. We will be finishing the rest of Declan Finn's Pious Trilogy, which is actually five books. There's the trilogy of the books, but then there's also a collection of short stories and the history story behind it. There's a nonfiction history book as well. And our current plan is to put those out one per month starting in January and get those re-released. So we'll have those out, and we have more in the works for that time period as well. And that's about all I can really...
We have three superhero novels in the chain.
We have three superhero novels coming next year. I can't give exact dates on that because those are all in progress, but we're expecting them next summer. And again, you know, we're very, very hard on that with the Never Hydra approach. Morgan is working on one of those. It's called Serenity City. There's a short story. Her story in Paragons ties into that world. I'm really excited about that one because I know the plot. And I've read bits of it. And I think that what she's brewing up is really fantastic. And I'm not just saying that because she's sitting next to me. I'm actually really excited. It's one of the books on our slate that I'm actually most excited about. I think that people are going to really enjoy that one.
I'm pretty excited about it myself because, you know, literature doesn't really seem like the proper medium for superheroes. Like, they come across fairly well, depending on who's involved in the project in film. And in comic books, you know, it's much the same. It seems like superheroes kind of need a visual aspect to the medium to be able to be told properly. So I'm interested to see how you guys handle that, given that, you know, literature superhero stories really don't, often don't seem to pan out as well as people think they would.
Right. You see, I wonder about that because one of the things that's really we found surprising is how little superhero prose there is out there.
Yeah, if you go to the superhero subgenre on Amazon, 95% of it is
it's really urban fantasy.
Like with wizards and stuff, not actual superheroes. There are a couple in there.
It's either with wizards or they're fighting vampires and stuff. And like, that's not really, I mean, okay, yes, we've all read some superhero comics with, you know, vampires in them too, but those are really the exceptions. So anyway, maybe you've hit upon the reason. Maybe it's a more difficult thing than it seems to be. Although I have to say, from what we've read in Paragons, it sure seemed like a lot of that came across very well.
Maybe you're just getting really, really good writers.
It's entirely possible. We have some great writers on that list, I know. We're very excited about those next year. We've got Spirit Cooking, the sequel, the actual direct sequel to War Demons will be out hopefully next spring. Targeting March with that, but that draft is only about a third of the way done, so that partly depends on how my schedule pans out, whether I can meet that target date or not, but that's the goal. And then we have a number of other projects in the works that aren't signed yet and I can't announce, but I'm feeling very good. Oh, yeah, I can give you one other scoop related to that, which is that the audiobook of War Demons is in production now. That just got signed today.
Oh, that's great. Who are you getting to do it?
His name is, we can pull it up again. It's not a guy I knew, but we've been working with him.
Cause I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. If I didn't have this backlog that I had going on right now, I would have gotten in touch with you about doing the audiobook for War Demons, because while I was reading it, the whole time I was just coming up with different voices for these characters, and like, maybe I'm just weird, but whenever I read a book, since I'm an audiobook producer, I'll read the dialogue out loud and do different voices for it. And this book really lends itself to audio very well.
Well, we went through an audition process on ACX. His name is Scott Allen. I just pulled it up. He doesn't have a lot of credits to his name yet, but he was also one of the reasons we picked him was because out of the people auditioning, he was actually excited for the story. And you've read the book, so you know why it's in there. But he got excited when the audition call asked for we wanted to hear his rendition of A Rebel Yell. And we had great fun working through that, and I'm excited on that. He has a bit of a backlog himself, so it's not coming soon. We're expecting to have that out in the early part of 2018, but it is in progress, and like I said, we're extremely excited about that.
That's very good to hear. I really was the entire time I was reading the book, I really hoped that y'all had an audio version in the works, because it deserves an audio book.
I'm excited to hear it. I agree. There's certain parts of it that just hearing the voices should be a lot of fun. And
his Jeremiah, Elijah, Ezekiel Jones voice is good.
His Jeremiah voice is good. His Jim Covington voice is really good.
I can't wait to hear how he diverged from my interpretation of these characters.
Well, I will say that this was for Jim Covington, one of the strict requirements on the auditions was that we needed somebody who could do a proper genteel Southern accent. And we were very happy with how that came out. I was very picky on that because, frankly, he's one of my favorite characters. So
Which
we
is
had to make sure
perfectly
he was treated
understandable.
properly. So that's just the stuff I can announce right now, which I can talk about. We've got at least a dozen more books next year that we're talking with people right now in the works for. So if all of that pans out, we're looking great. And we have several other people on the list that we're going to be reaching out to very soon. So 2018 is going to be a great year for us.
I am very much looking forward to it. There's so like John Mollison, I love quoting him on this. We really do have an embarrassment of riches right now, and more publishers like Castalia House and Silver Empire just continue to add on to the pile of wealth that we have of good stories,
There's
and will
a name
help
I
to
forgot
draw
to
in
mention.
more readers, honestly.
Yeah, there's a name I forgot to mention. John Mollison has a story in Paragons.
Oh, that's something I'm very interested in reading because John
We've
Mollison's
got a
work is
really great
amazing.
we've got a really great lineup in that. I'm really excited for that one. So, yeah, I mean that's a quick overview of what we've got coming. And like I said, we're getting ready to ramp things up even more. So strap down and get ready for the
My body is ready. There was one other thing that I wanted to go over, but if you don't want to, that's fine. The recent, well, I say recent, this was like 2 months ago, the kerfuffle with Declan Finn, that popped up, and the kind of breaking of the sad puppies. Would you be willing to speak to that?
Yeah, we'll talk about it. I might be careful what I
Yeah, I
say.
got really worried.
We
Sling dirt or start it up
I
again.
will
Yeah,
say that we
I'm not trying to start
got
it up again. I'm not trying to, dig up bodies or anything. It's just like it's something that really disappointed me, and you were very involved in that particular controversy, and I would kind of like to hear it from your perspective.
Well, like I said, I don't want to go too much into it because it has died down and we'd really rather let it stay that way.
Well, if we don't if you
But
don't want to talk about it, then it's
no,
perfectly fine.
I don't mind talking about it. I just want to be cautious in it. Really, my whole beef in it from the beginning, my only beef in it was the way that Declan Finn was being treated.
That was one of my big beefs too, because I interact with Declan Finn fairly frequently on Twitter, and I've talked with the guy in DMs, and he just seems like one of the nicest guys that you would ever meet.
He is, we love Declan. He's put out some great work for us, and we're putting out some great more work from him in the future. And one thing I will tell you about Declan Finn, having worked with him directly, is oh my God, the man's productivity. It's unbelievable how quickly he can turn stuff around and get it back to us.
Half the writers out there are not working as hard as
No.
Declan Finn is.
He is working incredibly hard, and we have a great deal of respect for that. He also has the social skills of a retarded brick.
Just to be clear here, we love you, Declan.
We do. We really do, Declan.
It's mostly just that he's over-enthusiastic,
He's very
Declan.
enthusiastic about what he does. He very much wants to help everybody. And he doesn't understand the subtle no. If you tell him no in any kind of subtle way, it's right over his head. It's not there. So you have to be very direct with him if you're going to tell him no. And my honest opinion is that that's probably what happened in a lot of it, is that he was probably very enthusiastically trying to help somebody who wasn't quite ready to directly, straight up tell him, no, don't do that.
And then it kind of blew up into this whole Mean Girls thing where
and
they're refusing to name him when everybody knows that's who they're talking about. And
that was honestly, if you've read everything I've written on it, that was my problem and what set me off. The problem is the way they did it was literally in a case of trying to pretend to take the high ground of, oh, we're not going to name this guy, when in reality, everybody who actually mattered knew who they were talking about. And it was really just a way of outgrouping him. And I'm sorry, but that's not taking the high ground. That's just not having courage. And anyway, we went into a lot of that. And the only reason I got involved was because of that. And they let it has dropped. And because it has dropped, we've let it drop. And we've stayed out of that. And I'm kind of hoping it stays dropped, frankly, because, you know,
it really doesn't do anybody any good to
it doesn't.
To
and I said some things about the sad puppies in that case that I honestly believe, but I also would have completely kept my mouth shut about it forever if they hadn't gone and picked a fight with my guy. And, you know, that's really all it was, is like, look, you guys picked a fight with my guy, so okay, let's throw down for a minute. And
it wasn't just, you know, like one person had a problem with Declan. It was several people that were attacking him. And seeing, you know, several people jump your friend if you're in a bar and you see your friend getting hassled by like three guys, you're gonna go over there and help him.
Right. And I don't know. I mean, I got hit from a lot of folks with people calling me a liar. And I'm like, I don't know where you're getting that from, because I'm reporting what I see, plain and simple. And then people saying I was listening to a bunch of lies from Declan Finn. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about, because Declan hasn't told me crap. I'm just looking at what I've read online. I'm looking at your words.
So Declan did not come to you and ask you to step in?
Declan did not come to me at all.
It's actually me.
Yeah, it was not him at all. He never came to us. In fact, I would describe his general status during the whole affair as very confused. Just like, what's even going on? You know, he I don't know what anybody thinks he's lying to me about, because I mean, I got that accusation a lot. Like, why are you believing Declan Finn's lies? And I really honestly have absolutely no idea what they're talking about, because I was just looking at what was written online on the web in public for everybody to see and responding to that. If something else was going on behind the scenes, then it should have been dealt with behind the scenes and not dealt with publicly the way they were trying to do it. And if there was something else going on behind the scenes, I have absolutely no idea what it was. And that's really about all I know what to say on it. I mean, I stood up and reacted because, frankly, I don't like bullies. And that's what it was, is somebody was bullying, and they were bullying my guy. And so we jumped in to help him out. And,
because the whole thing seemed really, really petty, and it seems like something that could have been handled, you know, in the background. You know, they could have emailed him or something like that.
It could have been handled in the background, and it... I don't even understand why it was talked about publicly at all the way they were doing it. I honestly don't even get that. Like, why was this even in a blog post? Like, people said some pretty horrible things about him on a blog post. And, you know, if you dig through and look at the specifics, you know, there's some pretty long blog posts on it, and you have to drill down to a couple of paragraphs to find some. But you find some of those, there's pretty terrible things being said in it. I just have to sit back and be, why? Why did we even go there? Like, what's the point? What do you gain out of this? What does anybody gain out of this? This is just stupid.
That was one of the things that got to me about it personally, because I like Declan, and, you know, I have a couple of his books. I haven't gotten around to reading them yet, because my reading list is huge, but you know, I interact with Declan on a fairly reasonable basis, and he just seems like the nicest guy ever. Just, you know, maybe a little bit socially awkward, but at the same time, just a really nice, well-meaning guy. And to have these people come out and make fun of him, like, not say, you know, okay, well, this guy doesn't represent the sad puppies, and if he wants to contribute, that's fine, but we're the ones who are, you know, kind of orchestrating this whole thing. That would have been okay. But they had to come out, and they had to make all of these just straight-up mean comparisons and metaphors about him and pretend like he was trying to take over the whole thing. And that really, really got under my skin.
Yeah, I don't know where any of it was coming from either. And of course, which was a lot of my point in the response, is like, what does this even look like? So yeah, I mean, we dove into it, and you know, I gotta be honest, we're a very small publisher. We have very personal relationships with all of our authors. You know, that's when you're as small as we are, that's just the nature of the beast. And, you know, we've got our guys' backs. That's just how it's going to be. They're on our team and we're on theirs.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. Like all of the reactions that I saw from you to this whole controversy were very natural once I understood the relationship that you and Declan have, you know. And the way that these people doubled down, like, that was the thing that really bothered me. It's like, okay, fine. You know, there was a misunderstanding. Some people wrote some heated blog posts. We can let this cool down, and we can all go back to being friends again. There was a misunderstanding. You know, let's just all back off. And then they doubled down on it. And that was what really kind of broke me with regard to this whole controversy, because they were acting like the people that the sad puppies had been set up to combat in the Hugo Awards.
That's really the most disappointing part of it, is that, to me, at least.
I would tend to agree with that. It's disappointing is the right word. It didn't have to be this way at all. It shouldn't have ever been this way at all. It's an own goal. There's, you know, just never had to happen. And I still don't understand why it did, frankly.
Honestly, I think it came out of an overreaction on their part. Because like you say, Declan isn't exactly the most socially adept guy out there. Which, you know, I'm not either. That's no huge crime. But if you have a problem with the way that the guy is doing things, then you can just go talk to him. You know, it's not like he's hard to get in touch with.
No, he's not.
Well, then his attempts, though, I mean, I don't know, they just kind of picked the way they were going to go and then stuck to it. His attempts to do what they asked became proof that he was a bad person instead of proof that he was operating in good faith, and it was just bizarre.
I gotta tell you, that was the absolute strangest part to me of the whole thing was, hey, Declan, we don't like that you were announcing that you're in charge of sad puppies.
Declan's response, to my understanding, he didn't do.
No, he never really did. And then Declan's response is, okay, I'm going to go update my blog post to have big, big, clear letters that say, I'm not in charge of sad puppies and don't have any direct relationship with them.
Here is the link for people who are running sad puppies. Yes.
And then the whole, see, he's trying to take over sad puppies. What? That just doesn't make any sense at all, and I have no idea. I don't understand where that came from. That part just blows my mind. I never understood that at all, and I still don't to this day. I don't know where that came from, and it just boggles the mind.
And I mean, looking at it from the outside, because, you know, I consider Declan a friend, but we're not exactly close. You know, we don't go out and get drinks or hang out in Skype calls or anything like that. He hasn't even been on the podcast yet. I would like to get Declan on the podcast one of these days, but I'm going to need to read one of his books first, at least. But to see all of this go down on the outside, it just seemed like precisely what the sad, which these people had been in the Sad Puppies for years, these people that were attacking Declan, they had been in the Sad Puppies before. They knew what kind of behavior that the Sad Puppies was created to fight in the Hugo Awards. And then they engaged in the exact self-same behavior that we had all kind of come together and decided that, you know, that's bad and we all shouldn't do that. It really felt like a huge betrayal.
I think the whole thing's really unfortunate, and I think a lot of people perceived it that way, whether it was meant that way or not. I do think a lot of people perceived it that way, and it's hard not to perceive it that way. Whatever is actually happening behind the scenes on their end, on the outside, that's certainly what it looked like. And, at the very, very, very least, there was a case of really terrible optics on their side.
That's a very, very polite way of putting it.
So anyway, it's the whole mess just really shouldn't have ever happened.
Yeah, and like we say, it has died down, so you know, don't go to the people listening, don't go and, you know, try to stir this brush fire up again, because the ashes have cooled, it's pretty much over. I just kind of wanted to get your perspective on things, because this was something that I saw in the blog posts, but I had never heard you kind of talk about in this capacity, in this format, I guess. So it's just this is satisfying my personal curiosity, and I appreciate you for indulging me in this.
Well, and I also have to say that there were a lot of people on the other side of this affair that are people that I generally have a lot of respect for. And I really hate that it turned out the way that it did, but Morgan will tell you that I'm also, I'm the kind of guy who's really just not afraid to piss people off by calling it like I see it. And that's gotten me into trouble more than once, but I'm just gonna do it. I'm gonna call it the way I see it, and I called it the way I saw it.
You're not rude about it usually, though.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I noticed, was that the blog posts were not, they were combative, but that was because combat had been initiated already. It wasn't something that you, like, they weren't, like, really polite about this whole thing, and then you came in and started lobbing bombs. It was like, bombs were already flying, so, you know, you might as well stand up and throw a few of your own.
Well, and like I said earlier tonight, I stand behind everything that I wrote, every word of it, but an awful lot of it is stuff that I never would have written if they hadn't started lobbing bombs. It's like, okay, I see it, but do I need to say it? And the answer for a long time was no, I don't need to say it. Some of it is stuff that other people had said already. Some of the comments I made about the leadership and direction of Sad Puppies was stuff that a good number of other people had already said before. But I'm not in the habit of just lobbing bombs at people who I consider, if not allies, because some of them didn't even know who I was before I wrote some of those posts. But people I certainly never considered enemies, and don't honestly think much of, period. I think badly of them, but look, I have enough on my plate without going out there and starting fights. I watch some of our author friends go out and stir up crap on social media a lot. I won't call anybody out by name, but you probably can guess at a few of them. And, you know, God bless them. I don't know where they find the time, because I have plenty. I have too much else to do. Wading into conflicts, I I have a lot of allies out there and I love you. And if things are going bad, I'll jump in behind you. But if things aren't going bad, you're big boys and can handle yourselves. And I have a lot else to do. So it's not something that I really just wanted to get in for its own sake.
Yeah, like if the personal attacks hadn't have happened, then it wouldn't be right. A deal at all.
No, it's, you know...
They can do what they want with Sad Puppies.
Exactly. I don't actually care. Sad Puppies is not my dog. Sorry, I'm not trying to make a bad pun there either, but it's not my problem.
But you did, and it's hilarious.
it's not my problem. I don't have anything going there. Except I will say this, and sorry to be a little bit vague on it, but you'll find out the details in the not terribly distant future. Several people at several points during that whole kerfluffle directly challenged me that if I had problems with how Sad Puppies was being run and how the awards process was being run, that I should put my money where my mouth is. That's coming.
Okay.
We have something in the works for that I think a lot of people are going to find very interesting. Look for the announcement on that either in late December or early January.
Well, let me know when it happens, and I will I will look over what you're doing, and if it's something that I can get behind, then I will throw my full weight behind you.
Yeah, we think that a lot of people will find it very interesting, and we'll see where that goes.
We've got some interesting or cool people
this is not just from us either. Yeah. In fact, I will have to say this one was not even my idea. Somebody else came to me about it first, and I said
it was John Delarose, wasn't it?
Actually, no.
But that was a very good guess. But I will say, happy frogs all the way.
Oh yeah, totally. That's just one of the things that really bugged me about this whole thing was that loyalty is very important to me, especially when we're all being, you know, basically expressly marginalized. The whole Pulp Revolution, the Superversives, all of this stuff. We might have our own little, you know, our own little saber rattling against each other, but we're all in this together and we're supposed to be loyal to each other. We might have disagreements, but at the end of the day, we're all on the same side. And it was the same way with the Sad Puppies until they started trying to other Declan Finn. And that just really, really bothered me because, like, Declan had never done anything to anybody, so far as I know.
Why are you shooting your allies? That's the question.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a gunfight in the Old West, and you shoot the guy to your left that's trying to, you know, fight the bad guys. And
I will tell you the other part of it. This is the part that has me scratching my head very hard as well, is several folks during this whole process very, very seemed extremely convinced that both myself and Declan Finn are somehow agents of Vox Dei, and the rabid puppies are trying to take over Sad Puppies. I can tell you, yes, I have traded emails with Vox Dei from time to time. That's the extent of my interaction with him. That and the fact that he published one of my short stories in There Will Be War Volume 10, which wasn't even his call. That was Jerry Pournelle's call. And
may he rest in peace.
May he extremely rest in peace. And, you know, that's the extent of my interaction with Vox Dei, is about a dozen emails. And, you know, through the act of Jerry Pournelle, he published one of my short stories. That's
so
it.
You're not one of the Dread Ilk or...
I am not one of the Dread Ilk.
Vile Faceless Minions or anything?
I have commented on his blog from time to time as well, and mostly been ignored in the deluge of comments that he gets. And the one thing about this that I can almost guarantee you is that Vox Dei did not care about any of it. He had
probably
more stuff
not.
On.
Like, that year, he had even retired the rabid puppies. Like,
yeah, he'd already
didn't even put out a slate.
And, You know, I had a couple people actually approach me during the whole kerfluffle and be like, "Hey, what if we tried to get Vox Day involved?" And I was like, "Vox Day doesn't care about this. Just don't go there."
Like, not only does Vox not care, it would be a bad idea to involve him.
Yeah, and he'll just get annoyed at you for asking him. He's not going to get involved anyway. And
but even if he did decide to get involved, it would just be an escalation of force, and
right, and
it would just blow this whole thing up into something that it really didn't need to be. You know, as if it needed to be at all in the first place.
But evidently, there really are people out there who live in fear and have to check under their bed for Vox Day before they go sleep every night. I don't know how he manages this, but
I mean, I'm not gonna lie. I'm not gonna lie. Vox is pretty intimidating. I've heard him talk about, like, just tell stories about how somebody left a fake review on Amazon. And he got the Dread Ilk or the Vile Faceless Minions to go out and find this guy and basically dox him, but not release personal information to the wider internet. Just, like, give the info to Vox. And then Vox, like, calls the guy at his job and is like, "Hey, you know, I'm Vox Day. You left a fake review on my book. I would appreciate it if you would take it down, or I will contact your employer about your activities in company time and stuff like that." So Vox kind of deserves the reputation that he has, but he does.
And I will say this in fairness too, I have at a couple points I have made some business decisions and had to talk to some people and say, "Look, the one thing I really, really don't want to do is pick a fight with Vox Day." Like, look, I'm not going there because this is just not something I want to do. It's not
worth it. It's not.
Frankly, it's not just him either. I don't live for picking fights.
You would actually rather not.
I don't want to fight. I want to make money.
Well, I mean, you're involved in martial. You have martial arts training, to my understanding.
I do martial arts training. I run a dojo, and I run a dojo and do a lot of martial arts training because I don't want to fight.
Yeah, but part of the point, like, I took when I was a kid, I took karate classes, and I've done some studying into martial arts. And one of the biggest things in martial arts before you even learn, you know, a chop or a throw or anything, is that you don't go around picking fights with people.
No, it's
this
stupid.
Is purely for self-defense.
If you pick a fight, somebody's going to get hurt. And it might be you, it might be them, but somebody's going to get hurt. There's no point. And honestly, I don't care. I mean, any of this stuff, I don't care. I have too much else going on. I'm really busy. I'm running two businesses and I work a full-time job and I have four children.
Four children. Good
my
Lord.
My oldest is seven. So my children are very young and demand a lot of time. And the honest reality is I don't have time to pick fights with anybody else. I have too much else to do. And I think that's part of the problem is that there's folks out there not calling out anybody, but Some people, just a general comment. Some people just really don't have enough to do. I actually personally, as a total topic jump, but I'm convinced that this is actually the root cause of SJWism, is that there are people who don't have enough to do.
Hey, you might be right about that, honestly. That's an angle I hadn't considered before.
And they have to find something to do, so they become busybodies and get involved with everything else, and they just do something productive.
as much as I dislike the Marvel comics that are coming out right now with the, you know, social justice Avengers and Secret Empire with Hydra Cap and stuff like that, at least these people are out there actually creating stuff.
Right. Yeah,
it's bad, and it doesn't sell at all, but at least they're out there actually being the change they want to see.
Right. You know, I'll give them that. I will. It's it may be small praise, but I will give them that. And I personally don't have a lot of respect for people who don't do anything productive. And I don't even require a high level of productivity to do something.
Just so long as you're not devoting every waking hour to being offended on the internet over
Right.
the most minuscule things ever.
I said productive. But yeah, so the take home from all that is that we do have we like to look out for our guys, and we do have something interesting on the awards front coming in the not terribly distant future. And I think people will be I think a lot of people will be very interested in what we come up with.
Well, I'm personally very excited to see what you guys are going to be coming up with in the near future. And thank you for indulging my curiosity with the whole controversy that went on.
Sure.
Because like I say, I'm not trying to stir up anything. I'm not trying to, I'm not trying to light fire to dead ashes or anything, but I just kind of wanted to know personally. And if you want me to cut that part out of the podcast, then I'm more than willing to.
We're good.
Nah, it's okay.
We're good. We'll probably get a little crap over it, but we'll deal with
If you're sure.
Yeah, we're sure. No worries.
But we've been going on for almost 2.5 hours here, so I'll go ahead and let you guys go. I know that you're busy, as you've said.
We are, but I have had fun. I enjoyed it.
And I really do appreciate you coming on the podcast, both of you, as a matter of fact. Thank you all very much. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to entertain this drunk lunatic. And it was a lot of fun. I hope that people will go out and buy War Demons because it's a really, really good novel, and I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass because Russell gave me a free copy of the book.
I appreciate that, Jim. I really do. And thank you for having us on. We really enjoyed it, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's no problem. Like I say, anytime either of you want to come on the podcast, just hit me up on Twitter, let me know through DMs or something like that, and we'll get it set up.
Will do. And likewise, if you want us back, just let us know.
Oh, awesome. Good to know. If I get a hold of the copies of the books when they come out and I actually have time to read them, I would love to have you guys back to talk about them.
If you think the reading backlog is bad on your end, imagine our end. I to all of my friends out there to whom I owe book reviews, and there are many of you. This is the problem when you're in the writing industry. All your friends are writers now, and you owe them all book reviews, and I love you all, and I really want to read your stuff. Most of you I know already are phenomenal writers, and it was what, June this year? May or June this year before I read the first book of the year that was not the first fiction book of the year that was not somehow related to Silver Empire. It's rough.
Can confirm. Can
It's
confirm.
and when you're running a publishing house, you have your own slush pile you've got to read through, you've got all the everything else you've got to read through. And it's I only have so many hours, and I owe several of you guys reviews, and I feel terrible that they're not out yet. They
Yeah,
are
I think I didn't I send you some copies of our books at Dimension Bucket Media? I seem to remember sending you some books.
You offered me one. I'm not sure if I ever got it or not. I'll go check my email. I do remember the talks about it, but yeah,
But
someday I
if it
will get
hasn't
to
gone through, if it
it.
hasn't gone through, just let me know. I'll resend the book, and it's not like the books have been up for months. It's don't feel bad
Someday I
about not
will get
having the
to it, I
book.
promise. It just, like I said, my backlog is at least as bad as anybody else's.
I totally understand. It's not that big of a deal. But yeah, thank you both very much for coming on the show. I really do appreciate it. Like I say, y'all are welcome back anytime if you ever have just a thing that you want to talk about and you want to come on a podcast and talk about it. Give me a holler and y'all are more than welcome to come on.
Okay. Thanks a
Awesome.
bunch, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you. Y'all have a wonderful night.
You too.
All right, and that is the podcast, everybody. Thanks again to Russell and Morgan for coming on. If you want to know where you can find them, they are both on Twitter, and I highly recommend following them. They are very entertaining follows. You'll also get all the information delivered right to your Twitter feed about all of the new books they are putting out through Silver Empire and the stories that they are publishing through Lioness. But if you don't want to go do the homework for yourself, that's fine. Check the show notes, and you'll find links to their Twitters and their websites. I would like to thank them once again for coming on, and they are welcome back anytime. But without further ado, let's get on to the sponsors and go ahead and wrap this up. We'll try and keep this short. So if you enjoy what I do here, the podcast, the posts on the blog, the audiobooks, the interviews, then there are a couple of ways that you can support me if you so desire. The first up is the Patreon. Due to Patreon kind of engaging in some shady business practices from where I'm standing, let's say, I have decided to go over to Patreon because they don't care. So if you want to support me with a few bucks, a few shekels in the hat every month, you can go over to Patreon and you will get audiobooks and e-reader files of public domain pulp stories that I have personally selected and put together for you guys. I only have one patron right now, and we're having some trouble with the payment processing. I'm not sure when it happened, so I have to go and check. But the stories for last month are basically done, and then they'll be available on Bandcamp at the end of this month, and this month's stories will be available on Bandcamp at the end of next month, and so on and so forth. So if you want to get them via Bandcamp, you can, but you can get them sooner, like a whole month sooner, via Patreon. Next up, we have the Kat Kimbridge audiobooks. I have done 6, 7, and 8 in this series, and it is very good superversive military science fiction. It's got pretty much everything you could ask for. It's got robots, it's got weird original aliens, like actually original aliens. Like, I've never encountered aliens like this. So there's some that are akin to them, but they're not exactly the same. So Andrew Beery did a really good job creating his own little universe here. I started out on book 7, so you don't have to start out at number 1. If you just want to get the ones that I've done, then I can guarantee that you will enjoy them, and they will make you want to go and read the rest of the series, because in between doing book 8 and book 6, I went back and I bought the rest of the audiobooks 1 through 5, so that I could figure out where the story goes, and I want to get a hold of his other books, because all of the characters in these novels have their own stories that he has published. He's an amazingly productive man. But Kat Kimbridge is some really, really good military science fiction. I highly recommend it. If that sounds like it's your bag, then go over to Audible and look those up, or you can use the links I have posted on the side of the blog. Next up, we have the Dimension Bucket Media Books. We have Hell's 5-Minute Tales of Horror, which is a collection of spooky microfiction by Hell Richards. It's her first published book, and it's been getting some very good reviews lately. We're very proud to bring this to the awaiting public. And if you're looking for some horror stories that'll get your spooky rocks off this Halloween that won't take you too long to read any of them, then go check that one out. We also have Dimension of Cobwebs, which is a collection of weird fiction from grandmasters of the craft at the beginning of the era of weird fiction. So right around the late 1800s, early 1900s. So we've got Edgar Allan Poe, which is, you know, he kind of started the whole thing. Bram Stoker, H.G. Wells, Frank Belknap Long, H.P. Lovecraft, and Hans Heinz Ewers. I feel like there's another one in there that I can never remember, but if those names aren't enough to draw you in, then I don't know, dude, check your pulse. Next, we have Darkest of Dreams. Darkest of Dreams is a horror anthology that occasionally delves into fantasy and science fiction by the Dimension Bucket Media crew. We've also been getting some fairly good reviews on this one from people who don't like horror. So you know we're publishing quality material over here at Dimension Bucket Media. But this is 3 stories by 4 people, so it's myself, Christopher Warren, aka Dimension Bucket, Connor Goff, aka Notshade, who's been getting a lot more active on Twitter lately, by the way, so you should go follow Notshade, and William Harmer, aka Gentleman Walrus. So if you like good experimental short fiction, some of it, my stuff's a little bit more formulaic. I like action stories, so my stories are a bit more action-y than most of the other guys. William Harmer's stuff is a little bit more cerebral and esoteric. Christopher Warren is very dark and Notshade. His stuff, like I say, the guy's got a special touch with madness. Then we have A Man Upstairs, which is a collection of creepy verse that's also been getting, like, all of our books that we've gotten reviews on have been getting rave fucking reviews. People love this stuff. So if you would go and buy it, and write some good reviews for us too. We would be very appreciative. But A Man Upstairs is a collection of creepy, dark verse by Christopher Warren. He is not a poet, and he hates free verse poetry. So, of course, he decided to write a book of it. And it actually came out really well. I like what I've been reading of it so far, and so do the other people that have read it. It was actually our biggest seller at StokerCon this StokerCon. Next, we have Cracked by Connor Goff. It is the story of a man who finds a horrible secret behind reality and then has to figure out what's going on before reality completely fractures around him. And as I say, Connor's a very good writer. He has a special touch with madness that a lot of authors really just don't have. So, go check out Cracked. Then we have Phoenix on the Sword, which is the first published Conan story ever by Robert E. Howard. So it really is the absolute first Conan story. And you can find links to all of these on my store page. Next up, we have Aaron Clary. Aaron Clary is America's older brother, the world's only professional asshole. He is a former banker and economist who blogs at captaincapitalism.blogspot.com, and he runs a consulting business at assholeconsulting.com. So if you have not legal questions, but questions about life, the universe, and everything, you can just go over to Aaron, pay him $25 to $35, depending on if you want a video. By the way, the guy has a YouTube channel. If you want a video, it'll be $35. If you want an email response, it'll be around $25. And ask him your questions, like, should I date this girl? What should I major in college? Should I go to IT boot camp? Should I go to the Bakken oil fields and open a bar? That kind of stuff. He'll help you out, and he won't give you no bullshit. He also has several books out, a few of which I have done the audiobooks for. So the ones that I've done the audiobooks for are Reconnaissance Man, which is more for the younger set, but older people can get some enjoyment out of it too. If you don't know what you're doing with your life and you don't know where your life is going, pick this book up. It'll help you figure out what you want to do and, almost as important, where you want to live to do it. For as short as it is, it's a very information-dense book. Like I say, Aaron don't play. He give you the straight dope. Then there is Enjoy the Decline, Living and Accepting with the Death of the United States, or Accepting and Living with the, I can never remember the subtitle. It's about how the United States is basically fucked, and you really shouldn't worry about it because there's nothing you can do. You specifically, you have to recognize what you can control and what you can't, and then care about what you can control and then work to change that and better yourself. It's a very good book. It's informed a lot of my personal philosophy over the years. I've read it through like 2 or 3 times. I highly enjoy it. It's my favorite book by Aaron's, and I like to think that I did a good job on the audiobook, but that's for you guys to decide. I should probably go read some of the reviews. Anyway, then finally there's Poor Richard's Retirement, which is a book about, well, it's more of a pamphlet. It's like 146 pages, but it's about how you, yes, you, can achieve feasible retirement for far less than people are telling you. Like, they say that you have to have, what is it, like $500,000 to retire? No, you don't. No, you don't. You need far less than that. And this book will show you how to get there and maintain that level of enjoyment throughout your retirement. So you can find the links to those, the audiobooks, on the sidebar of the blog. I do not get royalties for those. Aaron paid me a flat rate, but he also shills me in his podcast every week. So, you know, quid pro quo, my dude. He also wanted me to mention Curse of the High IQ. A lot of people that listen to this podcast are kind of nerdy and geeky and shit like that, which makes sense because I talk about a lot of nerdy and geeky shit, so it stands to reason that a lot of people that listen to this podcast would probably have high IQs and not really realize it. So if you ever thought that you were stupid in school because you couldn't keep up, or there was a certain subject that you just didn't get and people made you feel stupid over it, or you never understand why people seem to be going so slow when you just want to get your shit and get done, this is the book for you. Having a high IQ can be a blessing, but more often than not, it's a fucking curse. So if that sounds like something that would help you out, go pick up Curse of the High IQ. I didn't do the audiobook for this one, but I think I have the audiobook, and from what I remember, it's very good. So I would have to go and check, and I'm not about to do that while I'm recording the sponsor roll. Next up, we have John E. Boyle. John is an author. He has written a very good book called Queen's Heir, a romance set among the Hittites at the end of the Bronze Age. It is a sword and sorcery novel, and it is just fucking pizza pie, fam. It's great. It's brilliant. And I'm not just saying that because he's paying me to do the audiobook, which I'm almost done with editing this thing. It's a beast. It's huge. The Kindle version is only like $5, and for that you're getting like 40 chapters of solid story and good writing, as well as a fully realized world. The whole thing feels very real, especially the way that the character describes it. You're getting swords, sorcery, demons, magic, romance, There's actually a really good romance subplot, and it's not like one of those, oh, we fucked and now we're in love and shit like that. It's like, no, they fell in love, and they don't even have sex in the first book. You know, they're just, they meet, they go on adventures, they come to understand one another and know one another better, and they fall in love. It's great. It's presented very well. So if that sounds like something that you would be interested in, and I think that most of the people who listen to this podcast would be, go check that out. You can find a link on the sidebar of my blog, right-hand side, in between the Catherine Kimbridge Chronicles and Aaron Clary's books. Next up, we have the affiliate programs. So the way that these work is you click the link, it takes you to their website, you buy stuff. It doesn't cost you any extra. It doesn't cost the seller any extra. But the company sends me a cut of their profits for driving traffic to their website. So first up is Amazon. So if you have anything that you want to buy on Amazon, and I mean anything, like maybe some of these amazing books that I keep telling you guys about, then you can go through my Amazon affiliate program, buy your stuff, and then it's a win-win-win. Wait, hang on. Let me count that up. I win, you win, Amazon wins, and the seller wins. So yeah, win-win-win-win. There you go. I'm horrible at math. I win because I get money for sending people over to Amazon. You win because you get an awesome product, whatever you happen to buy. The seller wins because they get money for selling stuff to you. And Amazon wins because they get a cut of everything. Next up, we have mycomicshop.com. So if you guys are looking for comics, this is your one-stop shop. I use this website for all my comics. I don't go to... The reason that I don't go and buy comics... I had an example today. There was a bundle that came out. Hang on, I can actually find the damn thing. There was a bundle that came out today from Dynamite Comics, which I like Dynamite. They put out some very good stuff. But it had Dark Shadows Vampirella crossover, Grimm, two Grimm bundles, Grimm Portland Washington, I guess that's what WU stands for, Grimm the Warlock, the Dresden Files, Welcome to the Jungle, the Twilight Zone, and Xena, Warrior Princess. So I was like, fuck yeah, this is right up my fucking alley. Swords, sorcery, warrior women, the Dresden Files, fuck yes. And I went and bought it. It was only like 10 bucks. And then I'm like, okay, how do I download these so I can get, like, so I can read them in Honeyview, you know, the program that I used to read comics in, digital comics. You know, oh, you have to go to your DRM-free backups. Well, the only ones here that are DRM-free backups are the Twilight Zone comics. So all of the rest of those are just on this website, you know, and if my account ever gets deleted or Comixology ever goes under, whoosh, that's $10 down the fucking drain that I'm just never going to see again. So I prefer to go and buy my comics physically. I prefer physical copies. That way I know that I've got them and they're right there. I can go read them anytime I want and it's not reliant on a website. So if you are like me and you want physical copies of your fucking comic books, you need to go to mycomicshop.com. I use this site for all of my comic needs except for manga. I completed my Wildcats collection. I got the Wetworks stuff. I got Cyberforce. I got The Nail. I got Godzilla in Hell. Most of my Hellboy comics were bought on this. I got the Frankenstein comics that Mike Mignola did a while back. You know, I don't buy Marvel and DC anymore unless it's used. I don't buy fresh Marvel and DC comics. I'll buy their old stuff, but I'm not going to buy their new stuff because I don't want them to make money because fuck them. But if you need comic books, then just go down on the left-hand side of my blog, find the mycomicshop.com affiliate banner, click on that, go buy your comic books, and then we all win. Lastly for these, we have Write Stuff Anime. So this is like mycomicshop.com. If you need anything related to anime and manga, this is where you want to go. This is where I get all of my anime DVDs. This is where I get all my manga. They have body pillows, but their selection really ain't that great last time I checked, because I really don't go checking very often, because body pillows are expensive, dude. Like, I don't know if you've ever looked into prices on them things. Those things are, like, easily above $100 just for the pillowcase. It's ridiculous how fucking expensive those things are. But they have the Nindoroid figurines, they have Gundam figurines, they have music CDs, they have drama CDs, they got, like I say, manga, DVD and Blu-ray, anime, porn. They sell hentai and actual real-life, real-people fucking porn. If you're into paying for porn for some weird fucking reason. I won't judge, though. So yeah, anything you need that's related to anime or manga, go over and get it from Write Stuff Anime. Same place, right under mycomicshop.com. Next, we have Project Wonderful. If you want to advertise on the blog, but you don't want to pay a lot of money, then for 24 hours, you can have a little block of ad space on my blog for literally pennies, probably less than pennies. My ad space has been delisted, so you're going to have to look me up. I'm under Jim Fear 138 Audio Productions. And you could just go over there, bid on the ad space, and then, you know, you'll have an ad on the blog for 24 hours. It's not great ad space. You know, it's not the best. It's just, it's there if you want it. Next up, we have actual ads on the blog. So if you want actual premium ad space on the blog, as well as a post on the blog telling people to go buy your shit, and posts on my social media. And if you want, I will do videos for you for YouTube, VidMe, and BitChute, but I don't really get a whole lot of interaction on those because I'm not honestly active on those platforms anymore. Not that much. I watch YouTube videos, but I don't really, like, upload anything anymore. But yeah, for $20 a month, you can get all of that, plus a spot in the sponsor role on the podcast itself for 4 podcasts, so 1 month. Last up, we have the Bandcamp. Like I say, at the end of this month, you're going to be getting some new stuff that's going to go up over there, and that's going to be nice and fun. There will be some new stuff up there soon. Lastly, we have audio commissions. So if you've got a thing for me to read, I will read your thing. I do not care what it is. If it's a textbook, if it's erotica, I specialize in speculative fiction, so fantasy, science fiction, and horror. But I will read anything. I'm not picky. There is a line right now. I'm currently working on finishing up the editing for Queen's Air, which I don't think is honestly going to take that much longer. Then I have the issue of Kirsova and Sudden Rescue by John Mollison, and I'm also working on Michael Kingswood's first Glimmervale novel. And then I've got a couple of other people that are, you know, putting feelers out at me for doing other stuff after that. If you don't mind waiting a few months, then I will read your thing, and it will be done well. Trust me. And there are two ways that we can go about this. One, you can pay me a flat rate, which means you're hiring Dimension Bucket Media, which means that you're going to be paying me the flat rate for my narration and editing, and then you're going to be paying a $50 mixing fee for Dimension Bucket Media's professional audio mixing. And there's an optional $25 charge for completely 100% original to your book music for your opening and ending credits. And for an extra $15, we can also do chapter transitions with the music that we make for your book. So if that sounds like something that you're interested in, go check that out. Hit me up on the contact form on the left-hand side of the blog. But if you can't afford the flat rate, I also work for royalties. But royalty stuff is going to have to wait until the actual commissions go through and I get done with the backlog that I have now. So we can set it up, but it's going to take a while for me to get to it. And, you know, if you don't mind me taking part of your profit every time the book is sold. But yeah, that's it. That's a podcast. Thanks again to Russell and Morgan for coming on. I hope you guys enjoyed it, and I will see you all next week. Peace out, everybody.